The ultimate cause of death was manual strangulation.
He duct taped my mother and threw her off the side of the mountain.
He played God. That's what he did. But once, you know, he was standing in front of us at the courthouse, I thought, God, there's no way she could have got away from him. You know, she fought tooth and nail. I know my sister.
I'm ashamed that he's my dad.
Yeah.
I'm ashamed that he has no remorse. I'm ashamed of how he treated your sister and what he did to your sister. And I didn't hear Tanya's story. Her story hasn't been told.
No. It's all about your dad. All about your dad. All about your dad.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to Real Crime Profile. I'm Laura Richards, former New Scotland Yard criminal behavioural analyst, co-creator and executive producer of the case of Kayleigh Anthony, which is currently airing on Oxygen. And with me today in the booth is...
Lisa Zambetti. I'm the casting director for CBS's Criminal Minds, where I cast psychopaths and victims and FBI agents and everything in between. And I have a real interest in real crime and the minds that solve those crimes.
And today we have a very special guest who's also in the booth with Lisa and I, and that is...
Melissa Moore. I'm the true crime correspondent for Dr. Oz.
Jim isn't here with us today. He's taking a much-needed vacation and break, so we hope he's having a great time. We do miss him. But we had a great opportunity to talk to Melissa, who is going to tell us a little bit more about herself.
Yeah, well, I mean, Lisa and I actually met Melissa when we were in Nashville in CrimeCon. But I had heard a lot about Melissa before meeting at CrimeCon, so I was really pleased that we got to spend some time with her there and for you to come on our podcast, because you are going to give us and our listeners quite a different POV point of view about real and true crime. So do you want to explain to our listeners your background and history?
Sure. It used to be very difficult for me to actually say what I'm going to say right now, which is I'm the daughter of the happy face serial killer. That doesn't roll off in conversations very easily. Like, hey, who I'm related to.
And I'd imagine that came with, you know, real shame and pain and stigma. And, you know, we cover always with Real Crime Profile the point of view of the victims, and we always bring them into the room. But of course, there can be many victims at the hands of someone, and it can, in fact, be their own family. And that's why we felt, Lisa and I felt, it was really important to hear from you. And we appreciate it's not an easy thing for you to talk about.
Thankfully, it's gotten easier over the years. And I never felt comfortable calling myself a victim, knowing how the 8 victims that I know of were tortured and murdered. So I came up with a saying. I called myself a secondary crime victim, just because it was collateral or residue. You know, It was just reverberated to my family and to myself. And you know, dealing with the stigma is a small, you know, small way of being affected versus the victims.
Now, you've called him the happy face killer, and I actually don't recognize that moniker. And I know that we try to downplay those kind of monikers that the media gives to. Who gave him that name? Was it? And where did he? Where were you from when you were growing up with him?
Sure. So we are from the Pacific Northwest, and these crimes mostly happened on the Pacific Northwest in California, Washington, and Oregon. Mm-hmm. And how he came up, how he was titled the Happy Face Serial Killer, was because he was adamant and prolific writing letters to the media and trying to get credit for the first murder of Tanya Bennett, which 2 innocent people actually went to jail for 6 years. And so my father, over the course of many years, was adamant of getting credit and trying to free these 2 individuals.
Right. So this is all talking to his narcissism.
Right.
And so before we get into him, because we have to be cognizant that he has taken the narrative and the platform time and time again on this, and I am determined that he will not today, when we talk about him, take that platform back. So let's talk about his victims to start with, because we do acknowledge you and your mother and, you know, your other family members. You've got a brother and a sister who were also victimized at his hands because of his acts. But of course, you know, you mentioned that there were at least 8 victims. Now, I would concur with that. At least there will sadly be others out there. But the ones that we know about, you mentioned Tanya Bennett. Now, she was picked up playing pool, wasn't she, by him? And that was on 13th of January 1990 in Portland, Oregon. And sadly, she was found beaten and strangled to death. She was a very trusting young woman. And, you know, some of the interesting things and terrible things about that case were that he had taken her back to his place. And after he killed her, and he claimed he had his own narrative about why he killed her, but afterwards he then went back to the bar and sat there drinking, so to give him an alibi. So it's clear that he was already thinking about things, and he left her body in a wooded area where there was a waterfall. And I'm going to ask you just to tell us a little bit more about that, just once we deep dive into the case. So Tanya Bennett was the first victim that we're aware of, and then there was...
And there was a Jane Doe, who was the second victim. Now, he called her Claudia. Do we believe that that was really her name or not, or do we know why... There's like a question mark next to whether that's her name or what her true identity is.
Right. Well, she was actually found on the 30th of August, 1992. So that's some time apart from Tanya Bennett. He says that that was her name, but she is still unidentified to this day, which I just think is truly horrific. You know, there are women within this series who whose family will be missing them, and yet... you know, there will be countless others who no doubt he did come across and victimized, and who, you know, victims' families still don't know whether it was them or not. So she is down as a Jane Doe. And then in September 1992, 1 month later, Cynthia Lynn Rose's body was found. She was discovered in Turlock, California. Mm. Now, he claimed she was a prostitute, a sex worker, who entered his truck whilst he was sleeping. But I have to say, I think that's highly unlikely, given that he was 6'6", 240 pounds. I mean, really, is someone going to wander in, you know, a vulnerable female? Of course, that's his version of events, and she's no longer with us to tell us otherwise.
So this crime happened in Turlock in California?
Her body was discovered there 1 month later.
In the middle of nowhere, you know. It's a very, especially at this time, very kind of out there, desolate place. It's not near a big city at all. So I don't know if there was like a truck route through there. I don't know what, but that's really interesting when you said Turlock. The next victim?
The fourth victim was another sex worker called Lorianne Pentland. She was from Oregon, and her body was found in November of that year. Now, again, according to him, she attempted to double fee him, and he wasn't willing to pay that money, and she then threatened to call the police, and he strangled her. Now, of course, that's his version of events, and sadly, these women are no longer alive to tell us one way or the other, but there was a victim who survived, and I'm going to ask you, Melissa, to tell us a little bit about Dawn. But it was more than 6 months before his next victim was found in June 1993, and she sadly was another unidentified woman. She was found in California, in Santa Nella. He claimed that her name was Carla or Cindy. And the police, in fact, originally considered her death a drug overdose. And again, when you think about vulnerable people or homeless people, you know, how many more, this concept of the less dead when they're so vulnerable and you have a predatory offender like this who may well have fallen victim to him.
And then next we have another Jane Doe. So this will be the third Jane Doe that we know of. And he referred to her as Suzanne. So once again, where did this take place, Laura?
So this was more than a year later, in September 1994, and she was found in Crestview, Florida.
Wow. So that's different.
Well, it is. I mean, geographically, he covered a lot of ground because he was a long-haul truck driver. So, of course, this gave him the perfect means to be able to travel the length and breadth of America. And, you know, we'll talk about just the investigation a little bit and how he was caught, because, you know, there are some clear concerns, I think, in terms of how long it took to link cases together. And particularly when you think about the vastness of America and just the fact that he was traveling so prolifically. And so the next victim, sadly, in January 1995, Angela Sabreeze was a young lady who he agreed to give a lift to. And she was from Spokane, Washington, and he took her to Indiana. Now, approximately a week into the trip, Sabreeze became impatient and, he says, began to nag him. And she wanted to see her boyfriend. That's where she was heading. And his response was to rape and strangle her. So, again, there are some salient features here about strangulation, and I want to come back to that because there's some insights, Melissa, that you can share just around the analysis of these cases. And, you know, this particular case, while he strapped her body to the undercarriage of his truck.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, this, I mean, these are the aspects of, you know, real crime that are truly disturbing. You know, very upsetting. And, you know, the fact that he put her body underneath the truck and dragged her face down for some distance, you know, and his motivation was to ensure that she couldn't be recognized or identified. And so her body wasn't found for several months. So again, you know, he's clearly taking countermeasures and horrific countermeasures as well to ensure that he's not caught.
And then the last victim that we know of is Julianne Winningham.
Yeah, and this was 2 months after Angela Sabreeze. Now, the interesting aspect about this particular victim was, of course, that he was in a relationship with her. And when we think about domestic abuse and when we think about coercive control, well, she was, Julianne Winningham was a beautiful, blonde, blue-eyed, she was a truck driver, right, Melissa?
That's correct.
Yeah.
Yeah, and she's a mother. She had a family. Her mother absolutely missed her when she was gone. And she had a semi-relationship with me and my siblings.
Right. And she had a son as well, I believe.
Correct.
And so sadly, on the 10th of March, 1995, and this was in Washington, he again strangled her. Now, she was really the only victim that he had a link to. And so this was high-risk behavior in many senses because he had been seen with her. And of course, he was somebody and is somebody who stands out, you know, at 6'6" and 240 pounds. This is somebody who, you know, because of what he looked like, would stand out to people. But it was ultimately this particular murder that really started to lead them to your father, because he had he'd put his name on the bill of sale of a car that she was selling. And so when they looked at that bill of sale, they saw her name and they saw your father's name. So then the detectives decided that they wanted to ask questions of your father. And I believe that they orchestrated a meeting. They knew through his long-haul truck driving through the company where he was going to be. And then they went and met him. And he was, the detective said that the colour drained out of his face, and they started asking him questions about Julianne Winningham. And one of the detectives had the presence of mind, and Jim and I, you know, salute him for this, to rapport build and to hand him his card and say, you know, give me a call, let's talk about things, and to make sure that he was building rapport. And in fact, your father did call him. And, you know, this was really the unravelling of his murder, his targeted murder campaign against women, and subsequently led to his arrest. But it wasn't quite as simple as that. There were some other key twists and turns. There were some departures, you know, and some anomalies with this case, you know, which we'll get into. So there are at least 8 women that we know of. But in fact, he claimed at one point that there were as many as 160 victims, which, you know, is a huge amount. But when you think about somebody operating and being prolific, there probably are some more.
How did you come to meet my dad?
I was actually sitting in a parking lot in Mount Shasta. I'd had a fight with my husband. And it wasn't too long before I noticed that, you know, I just had a feeling that someone was watching me.
The man I then called Daddy was on the hunt.
But let's just talk a little bit about Dawn, because there's one particular victim who we believe escaped and survived. What can you tell us about her, Melissa?
I first heard the name Dawn when I was about 13 years old. My parents were divorced in 1990, about the same time he started to kill, I believe Tonya Bennett was shortly after my parents' separation. So for a span of 5 years, my dad would come and visit Spokane, Washington, where I lived, and he would spend summers with us. And this one particular summer, he came to pick us up, my siblings and I, and he talked about an altercation, a problem that he had dating. And what he said is he went on this date and that things turned ugly and bad, and it was a he said, she said type of situation where ultimately there was a warrant for his arrest, and he went and spoke to authorities. And the date was with a lady named Dawn. Now, as a teenager, that struck me as odd that this date would go horribly awry, where the fact that you would need a warrant for your arrest. So I was interested to hear about what my dad's take on this was, knowing that it wasn't the full truth. But I was terrified, obviously, to know that my dad, I mean, this was the first time that I would hear that my dad would do anything criminal, to the point where he would be subject for questioning. So he brought up the lady named Dawn. He then, mind you, I was a teenager and my siblings are even younger. He started to talk about a sexual act performed in the car, and that she believes that it wasn't consensual, and then went to the authorities. That's all I knew.
Why do you think he's even brought that up to you? What? Why would he tell you that?
I mean, he obviously went into detail in the car. I always wondered, like, why would he share these explicit details with us about his sex life with women he was dating? When I was younger, he would share details about his relations with my mother and how she constantly rejected him. I remember hearing, I guess apparently my mom would tell him to put it in a keyhole or something. That used to be this, like, saying. Huh. I don't know if it's true, if my mom said that or not. Right. I haven't asked her about that. Right. But he claims that in his marriage with my mom, he was constantly sexually rejected, and that he had a very different sexual life with other women.
So, Laura, what do you think about that, that he felt like he needed to tell his daughter about this altercation and have her be on his side? Or, I mean, why bring it up at all? Why not just, not deal with whatever was going on with that?
Well, sometimes even with serial killers, they want to talk to someone, right? And, sometimes it's excitement or talking something through. They kind of relive it. Other times, it's leakage and things just come tumbling out. Now, there were a couple of occasions, I remember you saying, Melissa, that, you were in his truck and, you were with your brother and sister, and some duct tape suddenly, came tumbling out onto the floor from underneath you, and you had questions about that. And
that was the last time I saw my father, and he showed up unexpectedly. I mean, that was a traditional trademark of my father. He didn't announce to anybody when he's coming. It was very random. He would just show up and unannounced.
Unpredictable.
Unpredictable, absolutely. And he would come to the house, and in this particular situation before he was arrested, this was my final meeting with him, and he came, picked up all three siblings, and put us in his semi-truck, and he drove my siblings to school, and I stayed with him. I was at the time almost 16. I was 15. And as my dad turned a corner, underneath his pillow, a roll of industrial-sized duct tape rolled out, and it hit my leg. And I remember seeing it peripherally, where the duct tape had originated from, and thinking that's a really odd place, even for a semi-truck. As they're compact, and there's things. You had to put things where,
sure.
Wherever you could put them, I guess. And my mind was trying to justify how this duct tape and why this duct tape would be underneath this pillow. And so my mind couldn't actually come up with a reason, so I just asked my dad. And I don't recall, what he said, but it didn't seem to make sense. But a lot of things didn't make sense on that trip, because my brother opened the glove box, and in the glove box there were cigarettes. And my brother was appalled, because in our family it was very much frowned upon that you would smoke or do drugs or drink alcohol. It was basically downgrading your character to do so. Mm-hmm. And so when my brother found these cigarettes, because he was looking for chewing gum, he confronted my dad. And my dad said those are for his friends and that he gives them to people that to ladies he picks up off the road, and he gives them the cigarettes, which was obviously interesting to us as well. I knew my dad did pick up hitchhikers, and I was witness to one woman that he did pick up on a holiday vacation. And I remember when we were actually not in a semi truck that time, it was a Christmas trip. We were going to the family cabin. And we were going from Spokane, Washington to Yakima, and we saw the stranded car on the road that had car trouble. It was a single female in the car. And so my dad pulled over and welcomed her in the car. She looked very, you know, reluctant, but then she saw the three kids.
Yeah, yes, that made it seem safe. Yeah, sure.
And so you could just read, because I couldn't really hear the conversation that was happening on the outside of the car, but I could read that she was hesitant, reluctant to get in the vehicle, but seemed comforted when she saw us. Kids got in the car. I believe my brother was in the front seat, and he moved to the back so that she could sit in the front seat. And then we took off to the cabin. And I remember, again, my father, instead of now talking sexually explicit things to me and my siblings, he was now flirting, joking, getting progressively more harassing to her, to the point that when we finally dropped her off at her house, she was visibly uncomfortable and shaken and couldn't get out of the car fast enough.
So that's a key learning point for our listeners. You know, sadly, I've seen in many cases where children or child seats or booster seats are in a car to try and make the perpetrator seem more safe. And so we always have to bear in mind that serial killers and predatory offenders can and do and will have relationships, and they can and will have children. And, you know, that doesn't make somebody more safe because they are a family. You know, it plays into that family guy, you know, good guy kind of image. Well, that is absolutely not the case. And I think just some of the things you've described are about him, you know, testing boundaries, pushing boundaries. You know, on the one hand, he was quite strict, you know, with you as children growing up, that there were certain rules that you had to adhere to. And on the other hand, he's abducting and raping and killing women. And there are some things that he will let fly, and there are other things that he won't. But I think he clearly enjoys and enjoyed, you know, getting one over on people in terms of his, what he might call his tradecraft. And you know, the relationship with your mother is an interesting one, because I listened to some of your mother's interviews. Rose is your mother's name, yeah, isn't she? I listened to her interviews, and she was with him for 13 years.
Right.
Is that right?
Right.
You know, and I thought it was very interesting just listening to her talk, but also just observing her demeanor. So, Melissa, your mother, Rose, she was softly spoken and demure and, you know, very much non-dominant. And I think that's an important, you know, her characteristics and how she was, that the dynamic was probably much more that he was the dominant force and she was much more submissive. And therefore, if he's dominant and getting his way and his will in the main, there's no need to, you know, to be physically abusive or violent. But I wonder how much he did try and control things, you know, the small nuanced detail of behavior. Because I was also listening to your mother speak about when they first got together, and she wasn't really interested in him to start with. Melissa's mum and dad got married in 1975, and that was after 9 months of dating. Now, he was apparently kissing the bridesmaid when she was in the chapel at the actual wedding.
Oh, and she knew that? Like,
she found out about it subsequently, which there's a concern. Well, actually, there are two concerns and risk factors there. One is the whirlwind nature of the relationship. You know, how well did they know each other? And the second is obviously that he's cheating on her and objectifying women right from the get-go. And, you know, I saw some of the video footage of, you know, you talking and seeing pictures of you as a baby, and you know, he could be seen as a caring, doting father, but your mother gave another narrative, which was he would hold you, but he would give you back very quickly as a baby because he didn't really know how to interact and couldn't really bond, you know, in a way. And well, some men can't, you know, in picking up babies, but he wasn't interacting, you know, on a free flow basis. He would hold you, but then give you back. But then he did invest some time with you and your brother and sister. But there was one occasion in particular that you talked to me about, which involved some kittens, which I thought was a real insight into him and his behavior. Do you want to share that with our listeners?
Sure. When we lived rurally, my mom was a stay-at-home mom. My dad, as you said, was a long-haul truck driver. So there'd be spans of time that he'd be gone. And when he would come back on the weekends, he would be very busy on the property, like burning debris, you know, cleaning up the property, the yard work and so forth. So my dad was home on this particular weekend, and I had discovered previous to him coming back that this feral cat had kittens in the basement area. I believe you call it a cellar, you know, and it was a pretty rustic kind of cellar. It was pretty rustic, and there was this it was really dark in there, and it was just earth. It wasn't cemented walls or anything like that. So I wanted to take them out of this environment because it's not fun to play as a little girl. I was just like about five or six years old at the time, and wanted to leave the dark environment and take these little kittens out and explore the outside, you know, just go out in the field and explore with them. And so I remember taking my had a skirt on, and I picked it up and used it as like a way to bundle them up. And sure. I put all these little kittens in it, and I carried them up the stairs, and I started to play with them outside. And they were like kind of, I remember wobbling around and on the dirt. Yes. I was having a lot of fun. I was so focused on the kittens that I wasn't paying attention to where my dad was. So at some point, I mean, this is so long ago, I remember it wasn't very long that my dad noticed what I was playing with, and he came. He approached me and he said, "What are you playing with? What are you doing?" And obviously, he could see what I was doing, and so that's what he would. He had this tone that he would use, just almost mocking. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to think of a way to say it, like just playful mockery, teasing.
Yep.
Yeah. So he said that, and then I knew that he knew what I was doing, and I couldn't understand why he was asking. And what I recall from that point is that he picked up the kittens one by one, and he just started to toy with the little kitten and play with it. And I remember being on edge and just watching his every movement, because my height compared to his height was extreme. I couldn't even reach him if I tried to jump and swat him. But he had the little kitten. He was petting the kitten. He was nice to the kitten at first. And then he held it by the kitten's tail. Mm-hmm. And that's when he started to, like, physically show me what he was going to do, that he could dominate this little kitten and that he was going to do what he wanted with the kitten, and which was there's a clothespin, a clothesline right by it. And so he was taking these he was going to hang at the kitten on the clothesline. And I'm screaming at this point because I know he's hurting the kitten. And so I run into the house to go get my mom to confront my dad, because he's not listening to me when I'm screaming. He seems to be more and more happy as I'm, you know, wailing.
The more terrified you're getting, mm-hmm. the more he's enjoying that. So it's almost not even about the kitten. I mean, I know that we talk about, you know, hurting animals, but it's more like getting to her, Laura, is that?
Well, I mean, animal abuse is a high risk factor, you know, to serious harm and homicide. And yes, in particular, if he is enjoying seeing a reaction from you, then that is the purpose of it. Would you say that he wanted a reaction, or was he just doing it for his own enjoyment?
At first, it seemed that he was enjoying my pleading, and then he seemed to go into, he seemed to be somewhere else then soon after, and that's when I ran into the house to get my mom, is that he seemed intent. He had an intent look on his face, and that he was intending to do something and no longer really paying attention to me, but more on what he's going to do.
Mm-hmm. And that makes sense. And so what did he do? I mean, you went in to try and find your mother. And so what were the next things?
When I came out, what I physically saw were the kittens dead on the ground. And there was some blood on the faces, and I believe, I didn't see how he killed them, but I believe he smashed them to the ground. Mm-hmm. That's what I believe. I don't know. I didn't see how he killed them.
Mm.
But from what I witnessed, the aftermath, that's what I saw.
Right.
And all of the kittens that were there?
They were all dead. All of them were killed.
And what happened next? I mean, you were obviously upset by that. Was your mother upset? Or what was the interaction?
It's, you know, my memory are just like fragments. And so what I remember next is my mom upset with my father, but it looks like she just kind of backs off on it. And there's a thing in the family that was just, you know, Keith is Keith. Just Keith's doing his Keith, you know, just doing his odd thing. And that's just Keith. I don't know. They just kind of shrug it off. Like, that's just Keith. And it seemed to be that my mom just brushed it over. I don't know. You know, I'm young. I don't know why, but I know that I can't deal with it. And so I see my siblings on the other side of the property and they're playing with cars in the dirt. And so I remember going and digging my hands in the dirt to make a little road and playing with the cars. And I found that to be very soothing to just be playing in the dirt.
I mean, very concerning behaviors. And I, you know, just to track back a little bit, because I know that there were other times when you said, you know, that you were laughing with him and joking with him, and that, you know, you had recall from when you were little that, you know, he was so big he kind of blocked out the sun.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, you felt there were some very good parts to the relationship as well. So it seems there are these kind of starkly contrasting aspects of your childhood.
Absolutely, because when he would come home, I mean, I could hear his car, you know, roll up and on the gravel road, and then we would just, all my siblings and I would just chase after the car. And then when he would stop, he would get out and we would, you know, pilfer his pockets for change on the road, and he would give it to us, and then he would pick us up and play with us. And when we get into the house, my brother or I would scramble to go find a blanket as fast as we could, and we laid on the living room floor. So, and we would sit in the middle of it, and that meant it's time to, like, play hobo is what we called it. I don't like. So he would, what he would do is like bundle us up in the blanket if we were in the middle, and then he would chuck us over his shoulder and then like spin us around, and it was a game. Like, wow. That was super fun, you know, and I enjoyed it.
Sorry, and that's, you know, a key thing. There's sometimes these really fun and happy memories, you know, from childhood, and then there were these kind of darker aspects that, you know, that you recalled. And certainly there was another memory that you told me about, you know, when we first were talking, which was about, you know, being in the truck and seeing certain areas, you know, wooded areas as you were driving past, and him talking about him killing women, and, you know, that he would take buttons off of clothes because he was worried about, you know, being identified by fingerprints being on buttons, and wearing cycling shoes so that he wouldn't leave a proper shoe print. But when he was saying these things to you, you were thinking that he just read a lot of the sort of the crime magazines.
Yeah, so growing up, I mean, it was something that I would actually do with my father. We would sit and watch Unsolved Mysteries at the time. That was the true crime kind of programming at the time. And then he had a fascination with crime. And then as the years went on, he would have these almost tabloid-looking papers that was True Detective magazines that would have cases that were ongoing in the United States. And so I would always see them around him. And so when he would tell me these details, I thought he was talking in first person, or really a story that should be in third person. That should be not from, you know, I thought he was like telling a story that—
You didn't feel like he was confessing to you.
Yeah, I didn't feel like he was confessing. Right. I thought he was just retelling a story, right, but in a different way.
So was he using first person?
So it's first person's him, right?
Yeah.
Like, he was saying, I would, and versus saying, this person did this, or that person did that. He said, I would do this. And he would always say, I know how to do the, I know how to commit the most perfect murder.
Right. But he wouldn't say, he said, I would, but not I did.
Yes.
He's saying
I would.
It, okay.
It was always, gotcha. I would. It was never I did.
Gotcha,
yeah.
Gotcha.
But he talked about, you know, it's almost sort of bragging rights of, you know, I would know how to commit the perfect murder. But he was really saying, I have, in the sense that he hadn't been identified, mm-hmm, because he was cross state and there were a number of countermeasures that he used. But of course, you know, when you're young, you're reframing things, you know, you're not listening for certain things like Jim and I would now of, you know, was he talking about things spatially? You know, was there an up and a down or where he was putting people or, you know, the little details that tell you whether it is a hypothetical or whether it's a true, whether there's veracity to it.
He asked me to change my last name while he was in prison. Well, actually, sorry, jail. When I went to go visit him to find out if this was really true. Was this really the case that he was wanted for all these murders? I had a hard time believing it. And then, so after I talked to my dad and the first thing he said to me was to change my last name, I knew that this was true, that I had to settle into this new reality, that my life was no longer going to be normal.
If we could just track back to Dawn, what was the version of events that she gave compared to his? Because they were strikingly different, weren't they?
They were different in the sense that she talked about going to the supermarket with her infant boy, that she had just gotten into a fight with her husband. She was married. And she said that she saw my dad looking at her and that he approached her from, he was in the parking lot leaning on car, and he approached her and starting to make small talk about how he has a daughter. He's a father as well, and his daughter just had a birthday, which would be me, that he just left from my birthday. And he had this conversation with her. Then she needed to get home. He offered to give her a ride home, and he stopped along the way to go to the bathroom. And when he stopped along the way is when he went into the bushy area to take a leak outside, and when he returned back to the car is when she said a different person emerged, and that's when he was violent with her and forced her to give him oral sex. And she says that her baby fell off of her lap and onto the floorboard, and that my dad was stomping.
And it must have been terrifying for her because, you know, he's physically so big. I mean, 6'6", you know, and she, as a mother, would be concerned for her baby. But interestingly, he uses you, you know, as the way to gain her trust and confidence, you know, at the start, talking about you, offering a ride. You know, I wonder how many more women, you know, did get into his truck, and maybe they did survive, maybe they never came forward. But she, Dawn, reported him stamping on the baby's head. And what happened thereafter? I mean, she managed to get away.
She said that, well, I believe it was my father who said he couldn't get a good grasp on her neck. Oh. And so she kept, like, somehow moving around. And then I don't know what caused him to go ahead and allow her to live and to actually drop her off. And so she was dropped off, and she went home, and she told me that she had this confrontation with her husband, and she called the authorities right away and made a report.
And how was her baby? I mean, was the baby okay? Or
baby was okay. I understand that he's in college now, that he's, you know, he's doing okay. But I was always curious about her because of what he said about her before. And I actually ended up connecting with her probably around 2008 is when we had a mutual acquaintance that connected the two of us through the internet. The internet was just like, you know, blogging was just becoming a thing. And, right. And that's how we ended up connecting.
And, you know, so going back to why he probably told you about Dawn, and he minimizes everything that happened. You know, it wasn't just a crime against her. It was a crime against her child, and he almost killed her. I mean, let's face it, she went into fight or flight. She fought for her life, and she managed to get away. So the fact that he tells you the minimum about it is because she did report to the police, so he knows that there is going to be a repercussion from that. But if he gets his narrative in first, he gives you, you know, a version of events that's heavily edited.
And his narrative actually puts her in a really unfavorable type of light, which is that she's drinking Jack Daniels and breastfeeding. So he kind of makes her look like this negligent mom. And I remember him adding all these like kind of these details that would would be shameful.
Absolutely. Of course he does, because it's down to him to discredit her. So whose version of events are you going to believe? I mean, that's, it's interesting because it shows that he's rehearsing his narrative, but it matters in some sense, you know, what you think to a degree, but it's more about claiming the narrative and having his story about what happened and discrediting her so that people just don't believe a word of what she's saying. You know, the shock and horror of a young mum who's breastfeeding and is drinking, you know, whiskey at the same time.
And she's taking a ride with a strange man, you know.
Even though she was saying she wanted to get back to her husband, you know, it's all a heavily, heavily rehearsed narrative for him. And there will be other women out there that he has done this to. And I think, you know, going back to your mother, who seemed to be, you know, demure and very softly spoken and respectful, you know, not having interviewed her, and there are lots of questions that I would really like to ask, but that 13-year being married to him, I wonder how much of it was actually with him and how much of it he was on the road. I mean, if you gave a percentage, what would you say the ratio would look like of how much time he spent away?
He's barely home.
Right.
Barely home. Yeah, I would say probably like 2 weekends out of the whole month. And then there were seasons, though, with his business that during the holidays, during winter time is actually when he would be unemployed. So the holidays is when we would see him the most because of that. And he would be absolutely depressed and upset that he had to be home during that time.
And so, you know, he really liked to be out on the road doing the thing that he liked to do the most, which was hunting women effectively. You know, this predatory kind of behavior, that this power and control that he got. And it's very clear that this is all about power and control. You know, it's his narcissism was the reason that he was caught, you know, and we go into that a little bit. But I think, you know, when we think about Tanya Bennett, I mean, she was 23 years old at the time, and she was a very trusting young woman from what I learned from listening to her sister, Michelle, because you met Michelle, didn't you?
Yeah, I met Michelle about 4 years ago, and it was a interesting meeting because she had some preconceived notions of myself, and I didn't know what those were. And so she thought that I was similar to my dad. She wanted to confront me because a lot of what's really difficult with true crime and what's difficult in general is just that there's a lot of people who exploit this genre, and they're voyeuristic, and it can give an appearance. But there was a movie made. Well, there's been two movies made on my father, and she believed that the most recent one, that I had somehow been a participant in that movie and that I profited from that movie, which couldn't be farther from the truth. I didn't participate in any movie, and I didn't gain any money from anything from that. And so she thought I was profiting off of her sister's death, which was not the case at all. So she came in when I had a meeting with her in Portland. I wanted to genuinely meet with her to find out more about Tanya Bennett, because there's like maybe, I don't know about what your research found, but there's very little said about her. And I wanted to know what kind of sister she was. What was the last meeting that she had with her? What was her family dynamic like? Just for me, I wanted to understand, because on the outside, it seems for me that it seemed just like a nightmare, not real. And if you meet with people, it can make it sink in more. And
it humanizes it. It gives not just a face, but the color of the person, you know, and who Tanya was and how she spent her time. And her sister and her were very close. And I think they're the things that we try and bring to bear at Real Crime Profile. And certainly through Jim's work and my work, you know, the victim side is so important, and it's overlooked so often. And as you said, it can be very exploitative, you know, in terms of people, you know, making shows or, you know, the podcast genre. It can be, you know, that people forget that these are people's lives. And your point of view, you know, the fact that you did a documentary where you wanted to meet the families, you know, and I really think that's admirable, Melissa, because, you know, it's a brave thing to do as well. You know, it's not your apology to make, but it is a burden that you carry. And yours and your mother's pain was very real to me in that meeting. You know,
I was terrified to meet with her. For me, there's a sense of, like, are they going to blame me? Because my father did tell me, you know, I know how to commit the perfect murder. He did tell me details of what he would do. Obviously, I was young. I didn't put it together. I would have never known. I mean, sometimes people say, you know, I could just kill myself, but they don't really mean it. And I guess I just put my dad in that same vein, that he's just flippant with what he was saying.
Yeah, of course. Why would you ever imagine that he was serious?
And also,
you know?
Like, now knowing what I know, too, I mean, he was my only frame of reference of a dad. Like, I didn't mm-hmm. have anybody else to be like, this is not a normal thing that dads do. I mean, I knew it wasn't normal, but I didn't understand. I just couldn't compute it.
And well, children just deal with what they have in front of them. You think that your situation is normal and it's the same as everyone else experiences until you get to a certain age where you realize, you know, you're around at friends' houses or you start to be exposed to the fact actually it's not. And, you know, realistically, how much time were you really spending with him?
Not very much. And so
he was an absent father. Yeah. And that's not to give you an excuse or an out, but it's a fact. You know, had already intuited and, you know, hypothesized he spent more time away than he ever did with your mother or with any of you as children. And, you know, if he's away 80% of the time, he's there for 20%, you may get some insight from that 20%, but you don't really know him. And certainly he kept some things hidden, not particularly well at times, but, you know, and you're a child. You trust the adults that are around you. It's just the way the relationship works. A child trusts an adult, and particularly when it's, you know, an adult that you want their attention and you want them in their life, but they're only coming back periodically. You want to enjoy that as much as possible. Now, when you look back, those dots all get connected.
They do.
But at the time, they were disparate and over a period of time, too.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you know, you're absolutely right as well that the moments that I got with my father, they were on vacation and they were things that I wanted to have. I wanted to have a relationship with my dad. I wanted to be close with him.
So we still have so much more to dig into. And Lisa and I, we definitely have more questions to ask of you, Melissa. And I know you have questions to ask of us too. So I think we're going to hit pause for now and we're going to do another episode and bring you back next week.
So for
thank
now,
you.
Yep. So thank you so much. And for now, let's sign off Real Crime Profile.
If you like our podcast, there are a few things you can do. You can take 2 minutes and go to Apple Podcasts and leave a 5-star review. You can also check out all Real Crime Profile offers and promotions and our sponsors in our show notes. Another thing you can do is go to Facebook and like our Facebook page. And you can also follow us on Twitter at Real Crime Profile without the E. And one last thing, please tell your friends, family and colleagues about us and spread the Real Crime Profile word. Thank you so much for listening. We really appreciate all of our listeners.
Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan. Sound engineering by Mike Thal. Music is composed by Simba Tsumba. Logo art by Jim Clementi. Real Crime Profile is produced by XG Productions and distributed by Wondery.
For advice and support if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0203 866 4107, or you can go to the website where there's a lot of information and advice that you can follow on www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic abuse, you can call the National Domestic Violence Helpline for free on 0800 2000 247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, shelter or counselling, you can call Genesis, the 24-hour hotline, on 214 946 4357. You can also go to their website for further advice or support, www.genesisshelter.org. And there's the domestic violence hotline on 800 799 7233.